Mr. Brian Lee. He's going to talk to us about some of the applied things that CDC has done in open source. Brian is a specialist leader at Deloitte Consulting, where he specializes in research and development, service-oriented architecture, and enterprise architecture in the Federal Strategy and Operations Solutions Group. He's currently advising the CDC Informatics Research and Development Unit, IRDU, in the Public Health Information Public Health Informatics Technology Program Office on strategic initiatives and innovative research. He has experience in multiple organizations leading teams of geographically dispersed architects and developers in designing and implementing an SOA framework for application development, that's service-oriented architecture. He has a Bachelor's of Business Administration. He also majored in Computer Information Systems from Georgia State University and has held positions as Chief Technology Officer and as a Principal Architect at several firms. He's a Certified Enterprise Architect, Certified Scrum Master, and has multiple certifications from Sun and Microsoft, and CDC is glad to have him. So, Brian?
Over in this corner is Dr. Savell, who's actually the director of the R&D lab and is sort of the, I guess, host slash vision guide for most of the engagements we're going to reference. So the open source activities that we've been working on were sort of an offshoot and a direct requirement of the engagements and the projects that we've been running. So the reason we have this open source stuff is because the projects were sort of asking about how we share and collaborate with each other and how we get more bang for our buck. So this is the obligatory, this isn't an official statement, it's just sort of our findings of what we have experienced in the lab. Don't take it to heart too much. So a couple of things we're going to talk about is you may be bored because you're going to hear yet another slide of what open source is. I hope everyone in the room knows, but every time I try to branch out and not include this information, people get confused and even more glazed look in their eye, or even worse, they start saying open source is something else. So you have to suffer through a few minutes of just level setting what open source is. Then we'll go into sort of the pros and cons of why open source is good. So some people love open source and think it's the best thing ever. Some hate it and think it's going to bring down Western and Eastern civilization. There's actually quite a few projects out. As Dr. Painter pointed out, there's a lot of public health open source projects now. This is growing larger and larger, and I've actually found out a lot at this conference, which is a good thing. So we'll go through some of those sort of best case examples of what we can learn from. And then one of the things I want to talk about is some activities within the lab that we're doing to foster open source development. So there's a lot of different ways you can go about organizing your community and working with your community. The lab is actually sort of a resource and sort of get some feedback on that. And then, of course, we'll wrap everything up. I'm trying to see if this works. Okay, cool. I have a remote control now. So just how open source grew up. So roots and history, nature versus nurture, that sort of stuff. This is the OSI's definition of open source. So if you want to argue with this, you can, but just not here. So it's basically a development method for software that takes distributed peer review, which many of you are familiar with from an academic standpoint and scientific standpoint, and applies that to software. So the idea is with open source, you get better quality, higher reliability, more flexibility, cheaper, and into lock-in. So you're not going to be subject to the vagaries of a particular person who owns the IP to that. The key characteristics are, and some people get mixed up with this, oddly, are if it's open source, you have to have a free runtime, you have to have free source code available, and you have to allow derived works. If you don't have all three of those, you are not open source, contrary to what someone says. So here's a bit of history. So some people find it boring. I am actually fascinated by it, so I subject you guys to a few minutes of it. The first software was open source. So IBM sold giant mainframes. They didn't sell software. So in the 50s, all the software was open source, and it got traded around freely, and everybody was really happy. That kind of went away for a while once a few companies started making a lot of money off software. And in the 80s and 90s, it grew up with the GNU and the Linux communities. So you had a lot of projects start up that were sort of accidentally created. People didn't want to necessarily sell it. They just needed a really good text parser, or they needed a really good DNS server, or they needed a really good something, and so they opened it up. That's grown quite a bit. So it's fragmented. It's gotten a lot of different use cases, a lot of different groups out there using it. OSI has collected 80 different licenses, so 80 different organizations who have put some sort of legal thought into a license, and there's sort of 8 major active license groups out there. Some of the big ones are the permissive licenses. So I think someone mentioned the Apache license earlier, which is sort of just tell people you got it from us and then do whatever you want with it, including reselling. There's contributive, which is the GPL, or the LGPL, excuse me, which is if you change something, make sure you share that change back. And then there's viral, like the GPL, which is if you use it, your stuff is now free and available as well. And different groups use these in ways that they find suitable. One of the things that's been particularly effective to the public health community is it's spread into government software. So one of the earlier projects was a security enhanced, or SE Linux, in the early 2000s, which was basically a bunch of bolt-ons onto the Linux operating systems to make it suitable to run in a federal environment, which has been adopted pretty heavily outside of the government as well, due to its security. Also, one of the big pushes that came out was when OMB issued their circular on how open source can be used within the federal government in 2004. A lot of states also had similar statements from their CIOs or CTOs about how open source software fits into state and local jurisdictional IT infrastructures. So this is where we get to health. So there's a lot of specific health tools and how open source moved into medical informatics. So that means all of your EHR, EMR, a lot of clinical functions, a lot of image management systems. A lot of these grew out or have been commercialized that started out with open source. So Trisano is actually a pretty popular system which grew out of disease surveillance and is available out for disease surveillance and outbreak management. EpiInfo is actually a project that started at CDC, released open source, and has had sort of a dual source license of Community Edition and then CDC endorsed edition. And there's really a slew of these out here. One that I kind of threw on recently is the FLISA, which is the Public Health Lab Interoperability Solutions and Solution Architecture project, which is in the process of sort of going open source. And they had some more information at their session yesterday. If you missed that, you can get it through the virtual conference. Another thing I want to talk about is how open source grew out of commercial and federal partnerships. So starting in the early 2000s, a couple of agencies actually started a large push into open source. So they did this in part of cost savings and also in part of sort of not having enough power behind individual projects or wanting to collaborate with other agencies, which they couldn't do through sort of formal arrangements, so they did it through informal arrangements with open source. The huge project which got some press recently is Vista from VA, which is arguably one of the oldest open source systems in government. And it grew out open source because it wasn't really intentionally developed that way, but over time a lot of vendors and a lot of partners developed software for it, and it formalized into an official open source project and actually relaunched last year, earlier this year. One of the big ones is NCI, CA Big, which actually had a lot of federal funding and actually a bit of international funding as well to develop a lot of open source components for cancer research, but also grew into other domains. So I think Dr. Painter sort of referenced that. It's a pretty good use case if you look at lines of code and also penetration into other projects of how that's been reused around the internet, around the health community. And of course, ONC has started to have, I believe every one of their projects is open source, or at least is being contributed into open source through a pretty permissive license. And again, that's done just to sort of increase transparency and increase community engagement. So the pros and cons. Some of this might be controversial, and if you find it so, I encourage you to ask questions during the comment period, because I like to talk about it. A lot of the things are sort of what makes up a healthy community of open source. So it's not just important that you have a project that's open, that's great. It's whether or not that community is active and if it's actually a positive force for your software project. We talk about risks and how you can get around them or work around them. One of the big changes is how it affects your scope and how you respond to the needs of your stakeholder community. And then, of course, in development best practices. In olden times, I used to touch software a lot, so I always go back to sort of the nitty-gritty of what are the development best practices. Tell me how to build this stuff. There's a lot of different ideas around what makes a healthy community, but the overall consensus is that if you have a healthy project, it's going to lead to more users using your software, more involvement with how users work with each other and work with the community. So it's sort of, if your community is healthy, your project's going to be healthy, it'll live longer, it'll reach more, it'll do more, whatever your mission is. An important thing that I like to remind myself of is the sick projects get forgotten. So if your project's sort of limping along, you'll eventually have no commits and you'll be sort of in the dustbin of SourceForge, where you'll see millions of projects whose last commit was 7 years ago. Doesn't mean they're not great. I'm sure they were useful at one time. But if your community isn't healthy and growing, your project is going to eventually get folded in or forgotten. So these are a few things they called out of what I think makes a community pretty good to work with. So when you're looking at projects to include or to work with within your own software project, you want to make sure that the project you're linking to, the project you're using, is healthy. Otherwise, you could end up pulling a bunch of code into your project that you're going to have to maintain yourself because there's not a group of people responding to forum posts and adding features or fixing bugs or addressing some new security regulation. So a healthy community is safer for you to use their project than an old, forgotten one, which are basically you're adopting yourself to take on. So a couple of them, again, not exhaustive. What's the activity in the repository? So how frequently do you see changes coming in? So how frequently do you see code? How frequently do you see people suggesting issues, closing out issues, entering bugs? Lots of bugs are actually good as long as those bugs get closed out. So one of the things that I always find kind of comical is when a project says they have no bugs reported. We've got zero bugs. We've only had one bug in 4 years. And you go and look, and it's like they've only had one bug because nobody's using it to find bugs in their software. So it's not necessarily good if you have no bugs. It's good to have closed out bugs. Organizational diversity. So is it one company just sort of dumping their source code out to the world? Or is it a mix of different companies and universities and agencies and countries sort of mixing in pieces and modifying little parts that they call their own and work on? Of course, higher diversity, better the project. High defect velocity or low days defect outstanding. So this is what I was talking about. Bugs are good as long as they get tracked, worked on, and closed out, and incorporated into the code base, and incorporated into a build. That's actually a healthy project. If anyone's worked on large projects or sort of read best case practices of Linux and Microsoft and Google, you'll see that there's tons and tons of defects getting closed out all the time, and then it goes gold, or then it gets pushed out, or then it gets versioned. And that's natural. What's unnatural is when there's no bugs. It means there's no QA, which means there's no testing, which means you're just sort of waiting for something to kill whatever work you're doing. Chatter, which really changes over time as someone invents new medium. So that means lots of forum posts. You have blog posts. You have tweets and retweets. You have lots of activity on the mailing list. Are people talking about the project? And what's nice about this is it gives you transparency to sort of see, one, how the project is used, but two, how it's maintained. So if companies claim to offer support, but then you see a lot of empty forum posts of asking for help, and then 2 weeks later responding to that, then you know you might not want to buy their 8-hour turnaround service because it doesn't really exist. And another feature, another characteristic that I think is important is a feature backlog. So if you see lots of things waiting to get built, and of course that's sort of getting knocked out over time, that's good. It means you have lots of users. It means you have lots of people interested in changing that to incorporate into the project. So a high feature backlog is good as long as it changes over time. So you don't want it stagnant. I think that's probably sort of the key to all these characteristics, is if your project is stagnant, your community is probably not healthy, which means your software is less likely to be excellent. So risk mitigation. So I'm a consultant, so I have to say stuff like risk mitigation because somewhere in the PMBOK it says that. But basically, one of the things that open source really gets toward is that the transparency of the project, it's going to let the group respond to a risk earlier. So what it means is you don't get stuff hidden into the schedule that you only find out once it gets released and someone enters a bug. Since the source code's available and since the project management software is transparent, you can actually have input a lot sooner. So that transparency allows you to see the danger, see the risk earlier, and hopefully respond to it. What that then leads to is you have sort of, you fail smaller and you fail cheaper, and you fail more frequently, but because you're failing little times, that lets you get to overall quality rather than having one giant kaboom at the end of a release phase where you find out it's going to take you 3 months to recover from. Instead, you're having lots of little blips throughout the sprint cycle, throughout the release cycle. One of the things that's kind of nice, and you have to be very careful if you're the governing body behind it, is not to abuse it, is that the whole logistics of the project and the strategy of the project and the direction of what we're going to do, it's really shared with the community. So it's pretty rare that an open source project can say, I'm going to do it this way, you know, my way or the highway, because an open source project, there's the fork, which means the highway is a viable option. And you actually see that happen where if a governing body does something that the community doesn't like, the community moves over and changes and does something their own. Forks happen, and forks aren't necessarily bad. Which leads to the last one, is sometimes communities break apart, and sometimes they come back together. And the interesting part is when you have these open source groups, and you have such diverse participation, the fact that projects can stay together and stay healthy is a really good sign that the software is around a strong use case or a strong real public health case. So dynamic scope and agility basically means that projects are going to change more than traditional non-open source projects. So what a project starts out and intends to do may be very different from a year later, from a day-to-day or from a mini-release cycle, because it's going to shift based on what the priorities change. And that sounds sort of like chaos, and it sounds scary, but because you have transparency in what that is, you kind of see those small changes coming, and you can move forward. So it allows you to sort of pick which parts you want to participate in, and overall, the community picks what their priorities are. It's not one person or one project manager. It's sort of the group determining through consensus or various other ways what the scope and the direction is. And it's also a low barrier to entry for new contributors to bring in new content or to suggest new approaches. It doesn't mean it's necessarily adopted. It just means it's easy for someone to see what's going on and suggest their own way of doing it, which is the source is open. You can do that. And again, going back to, there's a risk that you can sort of break off if it's not corralled right or if there's not enough good communication, because a lot of times you get sort of, you know, five really strong egos who swear they know the right way, and they either hammer out the differences and get a project, or they end up breaking the whole project apart. Sometimes it happens. So some of the best practices. This is really going to vary from a project-to-project basis, but what I wanted to capture is some of the stuff as our lab engagements and our own lab internal projects ran. We came up with some sort of development best practices that we use internally. It doesn't mean that every open source project uses these. It doesn't mean that your project should. It just means we kind of think it's a good idea. One of the pieces are, if you can pick a common set of tools for your project, it lets new members or new participants come in easily. So if every developer is using a different IDE, and every tester is using a different test tool, and every project manager is using a different code repository, then not only is it sort of overhead syncing those up, then someone new coming into the project is going to have a tough time getting their build working or finding out what the dependencies are. So just pick, at least from the project or sub-project level, pick some set of tools and then use that. The same thing for coding standards. So there's not a best coding standard. There's not a best tab size, but each project should have one. So if you're going to agree on a naming convention, poll your developers in the beginning, pick one. Many times you'll find that it's arbitrary, and it doesn't really matter unless you don't pick one of these coding standards or participation rules. So just settle on a workflow, publish it, rules of the playground, let people see what you're going to do, and then work according to that, rather than sort of having source files with 19 different formats. Because it's not that it's necessarily bad, it just makes it harder for others to participate and to review what's going on in your project. And one of the things that I've pointed out is, or I've discovered, is the lab is actually a really small team. I think we have like five contractors and 1.7 FTEs. And what these rules are is sort of a constant struggle and a constant tweak, but we make sure to sort of keep them public and agreed to. So we don't have three developers always going off in a different way. We have sort of three developers arguing over how to change what the coding standard should be, which is a very key distinguishing feature, because one lets you go forward with developing new software. The other sort of gets you involved in long, day-long arguments over, you know, where to put semicolons, which is not really that productive. I wanted to call out a couple projects that we've seen as sort of role models within the public health environment. Some of them are kind of old, some of them are newish, but they all have sort of useful lessons for us. In the surveillance area, sort of the, I say like grandfathers of open source in a good way, because they really pioneered a lot of stuff when you look at Rods and Essence, of how they took surveillance software, and some of these components started out proprietary software and ended up open source. Of course, Rods is developed by Pittsburgh, and Essence was developed by Johns Hopkins APL. And they both started for different but related needs, and they both kind of got towards open source in different manners. Rods is actually an interesting example of, since it's university-sponsored, it's actually a GPL, LGPL license, and so that's how they sort of continue on with their development while allowing others to participate and reuse. The next one is ONC. So ONC, again, is sort of an example of how communities can come together and then sort of break apart, and that's okay. And since the Direct project is a very, very lightweight, software simple, permissive license for exchanging software, exchanging files or data point-to-point using SMIME and SMTP, and it was developed collaboratively, it's a, you know, simple set of software. The NWHIN Exchange Connect software is sort of a larger HIE in a box set of software that builds on a lot of open source components. And what's interesting that came out of that was the Alembic Foundation sort of took Connect and wanted to improve on it. So they took the code base, which was available under its license. It was, you know, a three-clause BSD-style permissive license, and they, sort of, depending on who you ask, either forked it or reappropriated it and used it for a larger overall community participation. But there's two code bases. So there's a repository for Connect and one for Aureon now. And they're sort of a similar software, and they're being developed by sometimes overlapping communities and sometimes different communities. But that's what open source lets you do. And at the point now you have more software, so you have more choices to go on. I want to call out some of the actions of the CDC, because one of the things that's interesting is I've only been working with CDC as a contractor for about 5 years or so, and it's very encouraging to see the change towards open source. So years ago, it was the idea of, open source is dangerous. You can't develop open source applications, and there's a reason why it's built this way. And over time, it's changed to we can really get better participation and more features out, and more importantly, better requirements in from our users if we develop in a transparent manner with open source software. So of course, we have the R&D lab, which is what I support on a day-to-day level. What's interesting is most of our projects are open with permissive licenses, but depending on the engagements, we've had programs who said, this software can't be open source. It's going to be proprietary IP. Our program has an algorithm that we don't want shared with the world. And the lab is okay with that. We're not open source by religion. We're open source by practicality. We use a lot of proprietary sort of cloud tools that you pay for through VMware and others. But we also use open tools that are free tools, but not necessarily controlled by us, like Google Code, Bitbucket, SourceForge, things like that. And lately, we've been moving towards self-hosted open source tools like Subversion, Jira, and Confluence that are actually running within the lab but are used for open collaborative development. And the reason we actually set up these self-hosted tools was because our own projects just got tired of having Google Code go down, which is kind of a strange thing if you think about it, because Google Code has a Subversion repository that they've hosted for quite a few years. And it was shocking the first time it went down, and then it was annoying the second time it went down, and then it got kind of frustrating third and fourth. And so we figured if we bring them inside, you'll at least know who to blame when it goes down, and that's usually me. So that was a bit more positive. And the idea is if we stood it up, we may as well let other projects use it, because it doesn't cost us anything extra, a few more megs of repository. A project that Dr. Savell worked on in the past was called PhGrid, which is around distributed query and sort of distributed health queries. And that was done under an MIT and Apache license. And that was initially done because that was the only way to collaborate with external partners. So it was a lot more difficult to get source code officially shared between channels than it was just to stand up a set of source code on a third-party cloud-hosted code repository and let people view it and contribute changes to it. So again, that was sort of out of necessity, not because everyone sort of sat down and decided it was the best way. But it ended up allowing us to collaborate with partners across the academic, health agency, and commercial space that we wouldn't have been able to without that. Again, I mentioned EpiInfo before, and it's hosted on CodePlex. And it's sort of a good example of how, I believe, one of the earliest informatics surveillance systems, which is 1989 or something, it's very, very, very storied and experienced, came around and sort of it was always available for free, and it wasn't open, it wasn't closed source or proprietary because it wanted to be restricted. They just hadn't shared it. So starting in 2009, they released the first community edition, and it's had quite a few downloads. So I want to go into sort of the existing infrastructure that our R&D lab has stood up and talk a bit about how we're targeting the engagement that we have with the public health informatics research community. Because as I said, our group is sort of small, but we work on a lot of things that we find relatively interesting, and we'd like to, one, sort of get direct participation from the rest of informatics researchers and developers, and two, hopefully be able to, pull in more source code by sort of if we show ours, it'd be easier to bring in others. I also want to make a point that there are millions of projects on GitHub and SourceForge and Google Code and everything. This is not meant to replace that, and we have no hope or dream of doing that. It's just this was stood up because we needed something that we could bounce and bring up and send down. There was a great example in the last session of the FinEAS, which is hosted on GitHub. It's a really cool public health informatics project. That's great. We're not trying to convert projects off repositories, and we're not trying to say SourceForge is better than Google Code or vice versa. These are just our tools. So I like to say that because the first question is usually like, why didn't you guys just run on SourceForge? And we did at one point. So this is the URL for our overall collaboration site, which is phiresearchlab.org. Under that we have code. So you'll see sort of this little hideous deformity up in the top right-hand corner. And this is an example of the failure of architects to use user experience and user interface design. So this was the feature checklist of, yes, we have a Subversion repository, yes, we have a Jira project management suite, yes, you can use your login to check out code. So that was what we had when we submitted these slides into the system. I want to bring up a copy, or actually just bring up the live version, to show we actually did change that a little bit, because as many people pointed out, that was hideous, which shouldn't affect the usability, but it really does. I didn't want to use it, and I sort of built it. So this is sort of once our designer actually went through and put a skin on it, which is the same content, right? It's the same links to Jira, the same little, you know, how to check out, but it's just a little bit easier on the eyes, and it links back and has some news, and you can submit comments and tweet and stuff like that. So again, it's not necessarily the biggest or the best. It's just something that's functional and operational and gives you a spot to go to if you want to view the code we're working on, comment on it, submit a complaint, send a contribution. We just need some place, some locus where you can focus your activity. It's a combination of our repositories using Google code. Some of our projects use Bitbucket, and some of our older projects are still in SourceForge. So it's sort of in the process of transitioning all that stuff into internally hosted repositories. And you know, some of it may just stay in Bitbucket because it's fine there. They don't charge much. It's free. We have an unstructured registry, which is just a place to dump data and dump documents. We have an issue tracker through Jira, so you can submit defects, feature requests, stuff like that. We're standing up a Confluence wiki, so you can collaborate and sort of do threads and comments. Here's a bunch of the tools we use. As you can see, it's a mix of open source and proprietary. So some of this stuff we have to pay for. A lot of it's open source. It sort of depends on what the right tool is. So again, we're not open source by ideological standpoint. We're open source by practicality of what we need to pay for, we do, and what's open and available, we do. And that works out pretty well. The target that we have for what code's going to grow into is really as a hosted hub for collaborative software development. So it's some place for public health informatics that's sort of a neutral ground, because we've had partners who don't have the resources to stand up a Subversion repository, or for some strange reason. Actually, in CDC, for example, it's quite difficult to take a CDC system and host it within GitHub or Google Code, because that's a third-party cloud service. So it's actually easier to host that within our lab-hosted repository than it is through a third party. Not impossible to go to a third party, it's just more difficult. So this is sort of a path of least resistance for CDC programs, at least. And we've had conversations with states who just don't know how to put their source code and stand it up. They just like to hand an old project to someone, because three times a year they get an email for it and they have to go find it. It'd be easier for them just to stick in a repository without warranty, of course, but at least then there's a URL. So it serves as that locus point for sort of the lab's open source projects for people who don't want or don't know how to host their own. We really don't plan on building any special hosting software, so none of our engagements that we're working on are open source hosting or open source hub pieces. You know, we use existing tools that are out there. We use Joomla, and we use Subversion, we use Git, and we use Mercurial. So our idea isn't to build new ones, it's just to put the stuff together that works. And we sort of picked Atlassian from a combination of there are a lot of other prominent health projects, and also they have pretty good support for open source projects. So the version control is going to be right now Subversion, because it's sort of the most common, but we've had some developers ask for distributed systems, and depending on the day, they either want Mercurial or Git. We don't really care. We'll stand up one of them if you want to vote. We're happy to hear which ones you like, because the idea is sort of whatever someone asks for and we have the resources for and it's reasonable, we'll probably go that way, because we haven't really done an assessment of bizarre versus Git, although many others have and are very strong opinion on it. I'm not one of them. The issue trackers, we're sort of getting Jira set up and getting multiple projects set into it, so you can actually sort of query by project by project by project of what's new or what's prioritized or what you can work on or what you can submit. From basic just collaboration and CMS document editing stuff, we'll likely use Confluence. And there's quite a few development tools that work around continuous integration, build, and quality of code that Atlassian's also put out. This is not also, it's not an endorsement of Atlassian. Doesn't mean we're going to only use them. This is just sort of the easiest set for us to install at this time. And will likely change over time. So a year from now, we'll probably have a different list here. And we're perfectly happy with that. One of the things I wanted to talk about getting towards the end was the organizational structure of open source. So there's a lot of projects I've talked to, not just with open, not with health or public health, But in general, it's like, yeah, we're an open source project. Like, we're open source. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. Where is your source code? And they say, well, we're in the 3-year-long process of open sourcing our source code, which is an interesting sort of problem because it's, for me, an open source project is not valuable because the source code is available per se. It's valuable because of the way the community can participate in the creation of that source code. So this is sort of an existing project of usually somebody is, and this is in the, you know, through the prism of CDC and how CDC usually works with contractors and FTEs, is you have a business steward and you have a technical steward. The governance group who controls it is sort of traditionally a group of employees of a health agency. And then the project manager and testers and developers and you know, HL7 experts, et cetera, are traditionally contractors. And then they sort of roll up through a variety of vehicles or ways that they collaborate. So the business steward and technology steward control the project, and then someone else builds it. This is how most non-open source projects are running. When it shifts to sort of an open source way, you still see at the top your steering committee, your governance. That's still sort of the traditional FTEs. It's still sort of people who work for the agency who are responsible for controlling what a system does or what a project does. So no one's supplanting that. And then your committers, who are people who can actually change the source code or edit an issue or prioritize, those are going to be still, you know, through some contract vehicle, they're still getting paid. You're not going to get a bunch of volunteers all of a sudden volunteer to run your software project for you. Maybe one day it'd be great, but most project managers are doing so because someone's forcing them and paying them to, being forced with a paycheck, it's kind of nice. And your developers, et cetera, they're the ones who can change it. And you have another tier of sort of contributors. They're not allowed to directly change what's in your project, but they can make suggestions. And that could be as simple as your tester doesn't actually go in and change source code. They just submit change requests, or they'll say, okay, here's a bug. And then that gets prioritized with the PM and worked on by the developer and approved by the governance committee up at the top. But the thing that's sort of, I think, is new and is going to grow over time, and you'll see this in pure community organized projects, is that this right-hand column that has dotted lines or sort of the dream of the future, is that in the beginning you'll have a public health community member who's just very interested in that project. So they dedicate their time by either using the software or finding a bug or writing some documentation, and then over time they become so interested in it, or they become sponsored by someone, so they sort of self-select to go into the committer group, and the existing committers vote them in and say, yes, we trust you to make changes. And that community member comes into the organization as a developer or someone who can prioritize or manage a lane of work or a task lead. And then over time, the sort of governance committee at the top can then elect members out of that committing pool and said, not only were you so good at making changes that made our project go forward, but we're going to bring you into the fold, and you get to vote of what the next project release is going to be or what the priorities are. And so I think the evolution of this is going to change from just, you know, business stewards whose job is to get the software out to community members who self-select and then get elected and chosen and supported and voted in, who will get to shape how the project works. And this sort of works informally because there are groups who just build their own projects. Like I mentioned earlier, there is a developer who spent their own time to make their own system, which interfaced with existing public health systems, released it under open source, and he did it because of his, you know, passion and involvement, and, you know, he saw a problem and wanted to work on it. And I think that this is, you know, one way, at least within our R&D lab, how we project that our participation with our collaborators is going to work, because as programs become more involved and our stakeholders sort of become more diverse, they become more involved, and we're pretty happy to have them just as users or to bounce ideas or to view a prototype and submit feedback. But it's now getting to the point where they're contributing lines of source code or pointing us to their library, which exists, and so they get to modify that. So in conclusion, sort of our goal is through our R&D projects and our engagements that we run to get public health's increased participation, and, you know, and all open source is good, but sort of selfishly in our own projects to make the lab's research projects better, which overall benefits informatics and benefits public health. And a couple ways of sort of what you can do is the call to action is, you know, just go to the site and participate. So it could be as simple as, you know, pointing out that we have a broken link. Like, we consider that an open source contribution. Thank you for reporting that broken link. It could be as complex as submitting code, or even using some of our resources to set up a couple VMs because you need to test something out. The lab is available as sort of a resource to the public health informatics community for how to do, you know, specific engagements to answer some question in software or in informatics. And so the idea is just, you know, sort of help us out and get some information for us or get it to us. And if you have any more questions, you can email me or email Dr. Savelle later. I think this presentation is going to be recorded and you can view it, but otherwise I'll hand it back to Jennifer for any questions that the audience may have.
Questions, and actually let's give Brian and Ian another hand of round of applause. Since this is a virtual, they're presenting this virtually also, we're asking everyone to please use the microphone to ask questions and let us know who you are.
Bob Harmon, Florida Department of Health in Jacksonville. Brian, we've had a project going for years developing a statewide public health electronic health record, huge project, and we've been considering open source. Do you deal in any of those types of projects with large electronic public health record projects, statewide, multi-county, single county, and so forth?
There's only one mic, maybe I'll running back and forth. This works. So specifically, no, we haven't worked with any of those software projects. Is your question around what it's like to transition to a different licensing model or just development tips? Because there's quite a few projects at CDC, at least, who are wrestling with how they transition from, you know, a 10-year code base to open source. And it's not as simple as flipping a switch, because you might have 10 companies contribute to that. Nobody even knows if there is a copyright. The government can't hold copyright, but sometimes contributors still hold it. Or they might have a library that was licensed for use, and so there's quite a bit of analysis that goes into that code base of how you open source it. And right now, there's actually quite a few projects. I know Rob Chapman, the director of the Division of Informatics Solutions and Operations, was talking about how FinMS, which is a 9-year-old system, is going through the process of how they open source. So it's not a unique problem. It's not a problem you're going through alone, but it does require a bit of analysis. The lab itself has gone through reviewing code bases to see if they're safe for distribution, because some of the code bases we used had initially sort of used some third-party libraries that weren't compatible with the license that we chose. And so we went through it from an architectural review standpoint and developer's review standpoint. We may eventually use general counsel, but what we're finding is that at least the general counsel we work with, open source licensing models is not necessarily a specialty of theirs. So right now, it's sort of whether the steward who's responsible for that project is comfortable for an architectural review and developer review of what those licenses are like.
Okay, we'll have our project lead contact you in your office.
Yeah, please, yeah, email or whatever your preferred form of contact is.
Anybody else? Sorry, I don't have eyes in the back of my head yet.
Hi, Mike Trubatowski, SAIC. Question for Ian. I noticed you're rolling up your line level detail into a summarized encounter. What's the frequency of that, and how does that impact then the ability to forecast out of that data for the state?
I believe, but I'm not absolutely certain, that we get messages sent every 15 minutes. I don't know what the frequency of our roll-up is. I mean, we could certainly process the records as they come in, but there's the issue of, you know, you're getting these encounter records. When do you know you have a complete encounter record, given that it comes in different dribs and drabs? So there's a certain point at which we don't want to don't necessarily want to roll up and call it an encounter level complete. And in terms of rolling up to aggregate data, we only transmit the data once a day because the receiving sources are only able to take, you know, you make use of the data on a daily frequency.
Okay, thanks.
Anybody else? I sort of have a question. Not sort of, I do. That instance of JIRA, is that available to see within CDC, to CDC projects, or is that something that strictly supports external open source?
It's available over the public internet. It's hosted in the R&D lab. There are a few restrictions to its use around what kind of data can be stored, so it can't have, so all lab projects are restricted by our security policy in CNA, so no PHI, no PII, no sensitive data sets. But most project management pieces aren't, that doesn't pertain to that. So any project really that wants to use it, it's available as a resource. You know, Dr. Savelle puts it into the queue when it gets built out. Right now we just have a few, we have two projects in it, but we could potentially add a lot more.
Well, we love JIRA. We use it for our bug, but we do have sensitive data in there, so we can't, you know, we don't want the world to know we have a bug in our particular application because of what it does. So, but that's very good to know, and there are a lot of projects that might want to take advantage of that.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, so it's interesting is the lab runs these engagements or experiments of what the impact of a technology is to public health. This open source site, the code site, is actually one of those experiments. So the idea is to test out what public health informatics projects need in order to function as a healthy community. And the idea is that we don't want to run this forever. We just want to run it, and if it's successful, then it would probably transition on to some other group within the public health community who would maintain it. And so that might take a month, or might take a year, or might never take off, and it might be a failure. But the idea is not that we host code forever for all projects, just that we do it until the experiment's complete and we have sort of a better picture of what it takes.
And one thing that occurred to me too is that a lot of these principles you were describing for open source are good principles for software development, no matter, I mean, talking about transparency and other things, I mean, I think are good. I was looking at that going, yeah, my project does a lot of that, and I'm happy that they do, even though we don't do open source. So